Accession number 29075, Reel 2.
Graham Meredith, Reel 2. You chose to. You chose a position in the Far East.
Yes, well, I volunteered for that and was then given it, yes.
What was your reasoning for?
I wanted to see the world, and also there were things going on out there. There was the Korean War was coming to an end, or really had come to an end by then, but there was still quite a lot of tidying up after it. There was the Indochina thing, and it was just more exciting to go to the Orient rather than flog up and down the English Channel. But, and I counted myself very lucky to be in the Newcastle, where we had about 18 of us, I suppose, in the gunroom, and we had a small chess flat, not unlike HMS Devonshire, and then we all slept on camp beds around the after flats, so the officers' cabin flat, in the after end of the ship. And I, of course, was in the supply branch, and so I actually was given proper jobs of work to do, which was quite a good thing, really, because it got me much more integrated than some people did. Some of the seaman branch, you know, they were being passed around from one task to another and never actually having responsibility. I mean, I had to run a section of the ship's pay ledger and get a ledger keeping certificate, which is a sort of job for a young writer to be doing, and very good training for a guy in my position. I wouldn't say I enjoyed doing my ledger time, but on the other hand, it was all part of a pattern. And then, having done that, I worked in the captain's office for quite a time. At one point, the captain's secretary was sick for a good long while, and so I was acting as the captain's secretary. And then there was naval stores time and catering, victualling time to be done as well. And as a supply midshipman, one was actually given a job to do. I mean, on naval stores, you would be given the after group of stores to run as if you were a stores accountant. And yeah, that was a good way of doing it. Rather more satisfying, I think. And the ship went around. We had an interesting time. It was fun going out to join her, because I went out in the Empire Windrush, a trooper, which took us as far as Hong Kong, and that is almost worth a book, the whole of that trip. But then we spent a couple of weeks in Hong Kong waiting for the next troop ship, which was the Empire Trooper, to take us up to Japan to join the ship in Sasebo. And we arrived in Japan at Kure, and then we had to go by train, the first time I'd ever been in a sleeper train, and it was quite an amazing experience, really. It wasn't too bad. Across to find our ship in Sasebo. And then we had really some, by now it was November time, I think, might have been late October, and it was getting jolly cold up in Korea, and we were up there for quite a while, but we came back to Hong Kong for Christmas, and two of our midshipmen went down with polio, which was very odd, and I've no idea where they got it from, but it seems likely that it may have come from our time in either the Empire Windrush or the Empire Trooper on our way out, because several soldiers had gone down with the same thing. And so, as a whole gun room, we were put into quarantine, and we were put into the naval hospital at the in Hong Kong, up on the peak, where we caused a fair amount of mayhem because we were all healthy and happy and we had nothing to do. And then after that, I think we went up to Korea again. Yes, we did. because we were up there for the release of the Chinese prisoners who didn't want to be repatriated to China and who were going to Formosa, as we then used to call it, now Taiwan, and which was the nearest we had to action at that time because we were buzzed by MiGs from North Korea or China. And we all stood to and fired a few bangs, but nothing alarming. And the that was at Incheon late in the January, I suppose, of 1954. And then we went to Japan, I think, and we picked up the commander-in-chief and took him to Hawaii. We might have had another trip into back to Hong Kong in the meanwhile. And then we went to Hawaii, and the ship went through the Panama Canal. I was allowed to go on leave because I have many relations in California, and so I flew to see them, and I rejoined the ship in Jamaica, which was a very good way of doing it. And then back back home to recommission the ship in the June, and that was interesting. I mean, it's a whole circumnavigation achieved. We then, having recommissioned, which was done by marching the old ship's company up Queen Street in Portsmouth, and the new ship's company came down Queen Street in Portsmouth, and now a funny little squad of those who were staying for the new commission, we were the last lot marching up the street. We were then about turned and tailed on as the last lot of the new commission. And then we went off to Malta to work up, which we did for, I suppose, about 3 weeks, and then on to Singapore, where the ship was going to go in to refit. And so on arrival in Singapore, that was the end of my sea time as such in the Newcastle.
Could you describe the Newcastle?
Well, I mean, she was a 6-inch gun cruiser with three turrets, two forward and one aft. She was modern in radar terms by the lights of those days. Had a ship's company, I think, of around 800, might have been a little less. A wardroom of about 40 officers, and then the gun room of 20 or so, or just under. She was a good deal less comfortable than any modern ship is now. I mean, the sailors were all in broadside messes, and their feeding happened in their messes. And they would, but we did have a properly manned galley. So the cooks of the messes really only had to collect food from the galley. They didn't have to go and prepare it in the galley, which was what had happened in earlier ships, and had probably happened in the Newcastle herself at the time of the Second World War. But she did have this proper galley had been installed, and there was a separate galley for the officers. The seamen's messes were very congested, all with hammocks, of course, and lockers, and then these long tables at which the chaps ate their meals and recreated and so on. The officers had reasonable accommodation. I should think only a very small proportion had basins in them with running water. Most people had to go to a bathroom, and the cabins were quite small, but they were, you know, cabins on their own. Obviously, the captain had had good quarters back aft, and the commanders had quite nice cabins with reasonable size, in which, of course, they also worked. They were their offices as well. But for everybody else, very few would have worked in their cabins. The ship was conventional steam turbine propulsion. I don't think there's anything particular to comment about that. She was not as spacious as the Devonshire, which I'd been in, but she was reasonably spacious, really. And she was a very happy ship. She was very successful in sporting trophies and things like that, which are always good for the morale. Our captain, who had joined only about a month or 6 weeks before me, was a fellow called St. John Tyrwhitt, who was the son of Sir Reggie Tyrwhitt, who was an admiral of the fleet from the First World War. And St. John Tyrwhitt himself had had a distinguished war with a couple of DSOs and other things to show for it. And he was one of those people who was very relaxed in his leadership style and his command, but he was absolutely on the ball. He used to dress mildly idiosyncratically, wearing check shirts at sea and things like that. The only one who was allowed to do that, of course. The commander wouldn't let anybody else. But he was really a destroyer man. This was the biggest ship he'd served in since he was a junior officer. But he was a very good captain, very fair and straightforward guy. The commander was Barry Anderson, who was one of the Hungry Hundred, as they were known, who were R&R officers who were recruited into the RN just before the Second World War on permanent commissions, who were, because of the rapid expansion that was required in, I suppose, 1938. And I met several of those in my time, and they were all first-class seamen and also man-managers. Barry Anderson was extremely popular with the ship's company because he could make them laugh. He was not so popular with the officers generally. With the gunroom, we thought he was wonderful because he treated us rather like sailors. But he was he was quite hard on the officers, really. He expected high standards of them, as indeed he did on the sailors. But as I say, he made the sailors laugh. He went on subsequently and really made his name as the Commodore of the Fishery Protection Squadron in 1958-60, when at the time of the first of the Cod Wars. And he did extremely well at that. It was just a happy accident, really, that he fell into that job. He spoke Norwegian, which he very quickly could convert into speaking Icelandic. And this made a world of difference with regard into the way relationships went on at sea, because it wasn't a shooting war, but it was very much definitely a barging war. And he was a great character.
Did you have much time ashore in Korea and Japan?
Very little, really. I mean, it was only ever a few hours at a time. In Korea, Incheon and up to Seoul on one occasion, and Seoul, which I'm told is now a huge modern city and so on, was mostly timber buildings and very run down and dirty streets, not many macadam streets and that sort of thing. We then went to, and Incheon was much the same. Pusan in the south, which is a port, was much better, and seemed really quite a clean town. It wasn't very big, and the other that was Pusan, and the other one we went to was Chusan, I think. When we went there, we played all sorts of football and so on against the Korean Navy. Didn't see a lot of it. The only other thing we had to do was to... We were operating a part of a task force which was commanded by the Americans. And, of course, the Americans don't drink on board, at least officially. And we went to anchor off islands on the west coast and would provide liberty boats and beer for American sailors on the beach. They used to get, it was a pretty nasty experience, really. And I did also, though, have a couple of days in the USS Oriskany, which was a carrier up on the west coast of Korea, which was a very interesting experience and was good fun, and I liked a lot of it, and there were one or two things I was decidedly uncertain about, particularly the attitude towards drinking on board, because although there was a total ban on drink, there was drink everywhere in that ship.
Were you well received by the Americans?
Oh, indeed, yes. And I remember still the chap whose cabin I was billeted in, a fellow called Sawicki, and he was most welcoming, and we were indeed, people were interested in what our lives were, and also what was our funny sort of rank, this midshipman thing that they don't have. And no, people were very welcoming. And it was the first time I had ever seen carrier operations of aircraft. And so that was interesting. Unfortunately, we were there for a really nasty accident that they had on board when a Banshee came in low, misjudged it, hit the round down, and the debris from the aircraft fell on the after gun sponsons, where there were quite a number of goofers, and I can't remember the number of dead, but there were several people who were killed, which was that actually foreshortened our visit. The Americans were quite keen to, well, they were going to have to return to Sasebo, I suppose, and so they offloaded us back to the Newcastle. But it had been a very interesting couple of days.
Were you in a position to know how the relationship worked in terms of the overall command between the Americans and British ships?
No, I was not at all. No. As far as the manoeuvring at sea was concerned, we were, I think, running on the American system of the Pacific Fleet, which wasn't that different from what NATO was developing. But it was very early days in force terms in NATO. And the Allied Naval Signals book, which we had in European waters, was not the thing we were using. But I don't think that there was any real problem. Now, I'm not talking in terms of politico-military, because I have no understanding of how that was at all. I wasn't close enough to the Admiral, so there was an Admiral out there who was the flag officer second in command of the Far East Fleet, Admiral Clifford, who did come on board us, but he had the Birmingham, which was the other chummy Oppo ship, more Oppo than chummy, he also flew his flag in the Tyne, which was spent most of her time in Sasebo. And what his relationships were with the Americans, I have no idea at all.
Did you see much of the effects of the war on Korea and on the Koreans?
Not really, no. Very little. Except that Incheon, Seoul, had clearly been battered about. But not in any way, nowhere near as seriously as the German cities, for instance, or even London in the Second World War. It was mostly artillery job.
How much contact were you able to have with home?
Very little. Weekly letter. You know, or a daily letter if I wanted to, but I was a young man, used to write home once a week and used to get letters, but I never telephoned or anything like that, because international telephone calls were very difficult in those days. Find anywhere to make one for a start. And when you did, you immediately got cut off and it crackled. And no direct contact with home. The newspapers that we received were always long out of date. But nevertheless, we did read. We had the Times came every day, and it was read, but it was always by then 2 or 3 weeks or something old.
What effect did that have on the seamen in terms of relationships and wives and girlfriends and so forth?
Well, times were different then, the way we would see things now. The Newcastle was out there for 2.5 years. I was there only for her, not as much as the whole of her last year. The leading writer in the captain's office, for instance, had a son he had never seen. And that must have been the case with many. But 2.5 year absences from home were accepted as the norm. People certainly missed their families, and I'm sure their families missed them. But compared with the wartime and its uncertainties, I would say that people were very much happier at the time of the Korean War than they would have been in the Second World War, and one was focused on the job without the distractions of family, and family when you thought about them.
What happened after the Newcastle?
Well, I, as a supply midshipman, was had to do some time learning about air stores. And there was a small air station in Singapore called HMS Simbang at Sembawang village, or just near Sembawang village. And so I went there, and that was actually, I found that quite interesting, certainly very pleasant. It was the first time I'd been able to go ashore, go out every evening virtually, except when I was duty, which didn't come around very often. And I was able to buy a small car, and the things were going swimmingly. And then there was I was learning quite a lot about the way air stores worked, which the principle was much the same as dealing with naval stores, but they were, of course, much lighter, usually fairly high priced, and so stocks were lower and things had to be more carefully controlled. And I found that interesting. Anyway, we had a helicopter squadron based at Simbang, 848 Naval Air Squadron, and they were flying Sikorsky S-55s, American aircraft. And there had been a problem in the air stores world, and quite a lot of disciplinary action against the officers who were supposedly responsible. But they were pilots, the two of them, and they were pilots who were actually working very hard, running a bus service around Malaya, from the forward base that we had in Kuala Lumpur. So a Stores petty officer and I were sent up to KL to try and sort things out. Well, the Stores petty officer did it marvellously. and it wasn't that difficult, but a lot of stuff, you know, had not been accounted for. And the real concern was if there were shortages which affected the operational capability. That was the first thing, rather than the pure accountancy, because the 848 squadron were the principal transport providers, bus service, for taking army regiments, or rather more companies rather than whole regiments, but really often flying 100 men into clearings around Malaya during the Malayan emergency against the communist terrorists. And it was a very interesting and formative time for me, actually, and I had plenty of good experience having to make decisions, recommendations for writing things off, demanding, you know, where we did find that there were operational limitations because of a deficiency, making sure we got the bits as quickly as we possibly could. And it was very good, actually. It sorted it out. And I had quite a lot of flying, particularly later on. I had about 6 weeks or something doing that, and I it completed learning. So I enjoyed that.
Did the emergency have much obvious effect on life in Singapore and elsewhere?
In Singapore, no. In Malaya, yes, substantially. I mean, the country was on a war footing. And when I was there in 54, in most of the country, the curfew still applied. And what happened with the curfew, this was the thing that was had been introduced by General Templar when he was there as the High Commissioner and as the Director of Operations. And the villagers were brought into the compounds around the police stations in the small towns and villages. And even to this day, you will find a smallish police station surrounded by a great big wire fence miles away from it. And those compounds used to be full of people sleeping in tents at night. But by doing that, you were removing the victims of the ransom, the kidnappers and that sort of thing, and the people taking the fundraising and food raising opportunities away from the terrorists. And it was fundamentally that which firstly provided cohesion among the Malay people and undermined the CTs. And the whole country was on a war footing. Very little travel from one area to another, even by Europeans. And so being able to buzz around in a helicopter was a rare privilege, I suppose. And it has been encouraging going back there. I was last there about 3 or 4 years ago, actually, to see how areas that had become pretty desolate because the farmers had not been able to tend them their lands properly because they were being brought in every night. We now you go back and fertile farmland everywhere. I'm a bit concerned at the amount of trees that have been chopped down since, but that's another issue altogether. But Malaya is a prosperous country, and much of that, I think, is due to the way that we responded to the emergency and the way the Malays responded to it too.